is Midday on WNYC. I'm Arun Vanugopal. When we think of activism, we typically conjure images of public squares and streets flooded with hundreds or thousands of bodies. But how do large-scale demonstrations and actions actually come to be? Nandini Bagchi, an architect and associate professor of design and history at the City College of New York, has a new book. It's called Counter-Institution: Activist Estates of the Lower East Side. In it, she argues that commercial spaces like offices and storefronts are critical to activism and to civic engagement. Her book focuses on three case studies of activist hubs on the Lower East Side. These buildings became central to community building and to struggles around anti-war activism, to housing, and to arts in the second half of the 20th century. Especially today when so much organizing is happening online, on social media, for instance, we think it's critical to understand why having an actual physical space to meet and to organize, why that still matters. I'm thrilled that Nandini Bagchi is able to join us here today. Hi.
Hello.
So in what way do you think an understanding of past community building and activism is relevant to the present moment?
So you bring up a really interesting point, and a lot of activist spaces early on relied on the need to sort of print posters. A lot of these spaces I speak of actually had their own printing presses and produced a lot of their own media. And, you know, everything was very hands-on, physical. They had to post signs if they had an event. And so even as this aspect of movement space has been phased out in the current milieu, there is still a very real and visceral need for such spaces. The people who work in these spaces, you know, often count on the support of their colleagues. Some of these movements are maybe very peripheral, and a lot of the action and planning processes go on in within these spaces. And so Saskia Sassen, who speaks about, you know, this kind of globalized culture, says physical space has become even more important, or cities such as New York or other global cities, Mumbai, you know, Shanghai, all these spaces within these cities have become really prized because they're the nodes at which the global economy is controlled. So similarly, within this kind of counter-institutional landscape, the counter-institutions too need to be located within these cities, within these spaces, in order to mobilize and kind of gather momentum.
So you focused in your book on three what you call activist estates. Define this term, activist estate.
So this is an idea, and the book is very much located in the Lower East Side, and activism within the Lower East Side has a very long and rich history, going back to, of course, this being the locus of immigration and immigrant groups that form their own mutual aid societies. It's a place where labor unions gathered momentum, as well as settlement houses are rooted in the Lower East Side. So there's already this idea of activism that is very place-based, very space-based. They own buildings. You know, each of the settlement houses still own purpose-built settlement house spaces within the Lower East Side. So I began thinking about this as a kind of counterpoint to real estate. You know, when you think of a portfolio that a developer or an investor has of properties, it's called an estate. So in a kind of juxtaposition or a countering of that idea of real estate, I thought of these different buildings and properties within the Lower East Side that have actually a synergetic relationship to one another. They very much rely on these spaces. You know, if you want to plan a meeting or an action, you have to, you know, call up Judson Church, which is sort of the center for one of these types of activism that's long going, and it changes through time, but the spaces remain rooted.
The book is very comprehensive, but it focuses on three specific sites on the Lower East Side. There's a building known as the Peace Pentagon, which is at the corner of Bleecker and Lafayette. Then you have the art space ABC No Rio on Rivington Street. And then there's El Bohio Community Center near Tompkins Square Park. Let's focus on one of them. Let's focus on El Bohio Community Center. It was an abandoned school originally, right?
Yes, the school was shut down sometime in the early 70s. It lay vacant not for long, maybe for a period of a year or 2 years. And in the meantime, you know, it was vandalized, the plumbing was stripped, the roof was dismantled and sold. This was a very rough time in the neighborhood. There was a lot of disinvestment. There was a lot of other abandoned properties.
And this is also, I guess, because the middle class, specifically the white middle class, had fled the city in hundreds of thousands of them had left the city for the suburbs. And so you had all these immigrants or people from, say, Puerto Rico arriving mm-hmm. without any social service. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it's a much longer story than that. I think it begins, yes, it begins with the white flight, so to speak of. But then there's also other circumstances. There's a fiscal crisis in the 70s, and so real estate is really devalued. So it's not simply that the Puerto Ricans arrived in the Lower East Side. It's sort of more the time that they come in. Yes, there's fewer jobs, there's fewer opportunities. So whereas other immigrant groups had arrived and found employment and opportunities, the Puerto Rican community was sort of at coming at a point in time when this wasn't possible. But the abandonment really stems from the amount of privately owned housing that was within that neighborhood, where landlords, due to the low rents and kind of escalating maintenance costs, chose to walk away from their own property. So this was an unusual low point in the real estate market within New York City, when people actually found it more profitable to walk away, abandon, or even burn down
As in the Bronx
buildings.
Often, or yes. in parts of Brooklyn, right? Mm-hmm. So you have really focused, though, on not just any kind of, I guess, buildings, but you're talking a lot about the role of the office when you think about organizing. Mm-hmm. And you include a photo series of desks in the book. And I'm just wondering, can a desk be a radical space?
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make is, you know, change takes time. And what appear to be impromptu actions of mass gatherings on the street actually take a lot of time and momentum and work by several generations, actually, of organizers. And the Peace Pentagon, this is a building that is affectionately called the Peace Pentagon by the people who work in there, was one such space that had a lot of different kinds of activist groups working there. And as the issues within the country changed, so it went from Vietnam War, anti-war activism, to anti-nuclear activism, to, in 1991, with a new war up ahead, you know, they kind of all mobilized towards that issue. So it's important to have the physical office space to meet, to plan, to collaborate, and really to argue about. And, you know, these spaces are not, these communities are not, they need to be formed through speech, through action,
negotiation.
And that's just the one case. In another instance, there's also negotiations with the city, you know, in terms of actually procuring the right to use certain spaces as gardens. So even though these appear as insurgent actions, it actually takes the organizing from behind desks, you know, to create this sort of radical environment within the city.
You say that the Lower East Side faced a near total removal of public services during this time. Just how bad was it?
Well, schools were shut down. And, you know, so the case of El Bohio, which we mentioned earlier on, was this abandoned schoolhouse. And so there was both a disinvestment in terms of from private landlords withdrawing from private real estate, all these properties fell into the hands of the city that was now de facto landlord of buildings, for example, with so many tenants and a lot of maintenance. So the city, which was already on the verge of bankruptcy, actually began shutting down public services. You may have heard of the Young Lords up in the Bronx, and the group that I talk about, Char, so very strongly affiliated with the Young Lords and that movement. And they set fire to garbage on the streets because there was no garbage collection.
This is an act of protest to set fire.
Exactly. But it was also pointing out to the lack of services to certain neighborhoods within the city.
So this is, you mentioned Charas. Tell us a little more about this organization. You spent a lot of time talking about their work.
Mm-hmm. So Charas is a very important and seminal organization. They were the ones that ran the El Bohío Center, and they began their organization in the 70s or the late 60s. And they were a group of, it was a youth, a Puerto Rican youth collective. And they began by approaching, one of the first projects that I speak of in the book was they approached Buckminster Fuller, and they decided to build these sort of fantastic domes in the Lower East Side.
He made the geodesic dome, I guess, kind of a worldwide sort of architectural statement of sorts, didn't
right.
he?
Right. So this dome that's typically associated with a kind of white, middle-class, college hippie audience actually found this kind of new fertile ground in the Lower East Side amongst these, and some of them were gang members, and so they had learned their political organizing skills on the street, and they approached Buckminster Fuller, and of course he, being adventuresome, was absolutely thrilled with this collaboration. And so this is this organization that then, through Buckminster Fuller, but also through various other associates, were very involved in education, arts, but also the environment, a very early kind of alternative technology environmental movement is what they're associated with in the Lower East Side.
I'm talking to Nandini Bagchi about her new book, Counter Institution, Activist Estates of the Lower East Side. So how were these efforts by groups like Charas, some of which were, I guess, might have appeared a little unsettling, burning trash in the street, but also a lot of it was cultural and trying to bring people together. How were they greeted by the political establishment?
I guess I focus mainly on the Lower East Side. And actually, so there's a lot of Puerto Rican activism all over the city at this point in time. You know, so the burning of the trash that happened in Harlem, and the South Bronx too. There's a lot of, you know, taking over buildings, doing sweat equity, reclaiming housing, reclaiming gardens. This is going on all around the city. Within the Lower East Side, and in speaking to some of the protagonists that were part of this movement, one finds like a kind of, although it's a Puerto Rican grassroots movement, and it stems from this kind of idea of Loisaida, as they call the Lower East Side, and created this sort of identity, a political identity for the place. It's a sort of a heterogeneous movement that grows over time. As I said, you know, they were collaborating with Buckminster Fuller. They also were reading Murray Bookchin and, you know, talking about grassroots self-determination and how that would work. And so it was not a purely Puerto Rican movement in that sense, but they actually leveraged this idea of identity and a very specific kind of culture, as well as like a kind of post-colonial idea of who they were, and, you know, sort of making the comparison between the island of Puerto Rico and Loisaida, this sort of exchange. And how was it seen by the political establishment? At the time when there was large-scale abandonment, they actually claimed spaces, they cleared out lots, they created housing, and the city and the federal government was actually open to this type of participation in the absence of any structure on their part to maintain and manage these properties that they found themselves to be in ownership of. However, what happened, of course, the well-known story of the 90s is as capital re-entered into the city, it was precisely places like the Lower East Side that became auctioned off during the Giuliani administration. El Bohio was put on the auction block. And so they actually poured energy and recreated these spaces that still exist. The garden still exists. Large swaths of cooperative housing still exists in the Lower East Side. And so I guess they had a kind of partnership with the city from time to time, and a sort of adversarial relationship from time to time, back and forth.
So in the minute or so that we have left, I'm curious about the present moment. If you walk through the city, you see so many empty storefronts.
Right.
They just lay there fallow for months or even years on end. Is there any movement to appropriate any of these empty spaces for physical organizing?
Yes, there are efforts. I myself am working with, in my capacity as an architect, on a closed down building in the South Bronx, and the community there is very strong, very well organized. They're called South Bronx Unite. They've also formed a land trust, and they're trying to get this vacant lot and turn it, vacant property, and turn it into a community center. They're also trying to organize, just not around this one building, but to create this community land trust as a kind of alternative to investor development that the city is so friendly toward. And the city, they're in communication with the city. The city is open to this idea of the community land trust. So that, I would say, is one model of trying to get commercial space that is affordable, because, you know, there's no mechanism by which commercial space is affordable. You know, there's a lot of work that people have done on housing, but yes.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking with Nandini Bagchi about her book, published by Fordham University Press, Counter-Institution Activist Estates of the Lower East Side. Thanks, Nandini.
Thank you, Arun.